You are listening to RudolfSteinerAudio.com. As well, you can hear these podcasts at RudolfSteiner.podbean.com. Please consider becoming a patron. There are two publishing houses, SteinerBooks.org in America and RudolfSteinerPress.com in England, which are the sole publishers of Steiner into English and have given me permission to do these recordings. Please consider patronizing them as well. This is a reading of Collected Works, Volume 174A by Rudolf Steiner, 12 lectures translated by Christiane O'Brien, entitled Europe Between East and West in Cosmic and Human History. This is Lecture 6, given on the 20th of March, 1916, in Munich. It is essential, while gradually assimilating what we are calling spiritual science, to bring goodwill toward what is initially something of a blueprint of imparted concepts and conceptual interconnections. I'd say, and to fill these out with genuine imaginations of what can at first only be communicated in the form of general outlines. You see, this is what we say. The human being consists of physical body, ether body, astral body, capital I, and so on. That is quite correct, for a start. And if we can put it like this, we then have to orient ourselves within a comprehensive framework of schematic concepts. But over the further course of acquiring an understanding of spiritual science, you will need to engage more closely with what has been schematically presented. Closer to home, as it were, within our society and among what is being offered to audiences, we have a large number of lecture cycles. But these lecture cycles contain comparatively little of what we might wish humanity, or at least small enclaves within humanity, to know as a matter of urgency. If we term physical body, whatever can be seen externally with physical senses, can be viewed by science and is related to reason, experiment, and observation. Nevertheless, underlying this physical body is, as we know, an ether body. Today, let us firstly cast our spiritual eye, EYE, over these two elements of human nature. Spiritual science per se, it would seem, needs to say least of all about the physical body, because it is the only element available to physical science, the only element it has any intention of observing with its methods. The physical body, even if initially viewed in terms of what somatic science deems it to be, can only be understood in its due significance and standing in the world if the higher members of human nature are also acknowledged and focused upon. Now, you will remember that the physical body, in the form, we could say, that it clothes or envelops the human being when on earth, could only arise during that terrestrial stage of evolution. It had already received its spiritual rudiments during ancient Saturn evolution, and was in process of continual transformation over the course of Sun, Moon, and Earth evolutions. It had metamorphosed under the influence of what was taking place throughout ancient Sun, Moon, and Earth epochs. It was in transformation due to the fact that an ether body was being embodied on the Sun. This physical body had to change from the state in which it had come over from Saturn and become different once it became suffused with an ether body. It had to transform again on the Moon when it was further saturated with an astral body. Not only did the astral body amplify the entire human entelechy, but the physical body was altered in that, during the Sun era, the ether body had to some extent precipitated inward. During Moon, the astral body had been added, whereas on Earth, the I, capital, was gradually being shaped from all sides, albeit initially within the ether body, but also within the physical body itself. If we now turn from the human to the cosmic, we need only recall what we have so often spoken about and what is contained in our lecture cycles. We therefore know that when the first rudiments of the physical body were made possible through what we might call an inpouring from spirits of will from the thrones, its onward metamorphosis during ancient Sun was enabled through spirits of wisdom, the subsequent transformation during ancient moon through spirits of movement, and the changes wrought on earth, that is, all that had to be refashioned on the physical body due to the eye indwelling it, was effected by spirits of form. This is a very important aspect upon which we need to focus. When a physical body approaches us on earth, we have to think of it as eye-endowed. Being eye-endowed, we must further think of it as having received a form particular to itself and appropriate for its time on earth. During moon, on the other hand, only inner movement suited to ourselves was received. The shape befitting the earthly person had to be received through a gift from the spirits of form, in due concordance with the fact that an eye was to be implanted within it. We can therefore say that this physically formed earthly body is shaped as it is because it had to become a bearer of an eye. In bestowing on the human being their eye, did the spirits of form bequeath to physical bodies the contours befitting them as bearers of an eye? The beings of the other realms of nature also received their forms. If you read the sensitive descriptions of ancient moon, you will see that all beings are described such that one cannot speak of them having the form they now possess. They are described as being mobile or labile. Think back to the descriptions in Title Occult Science and Outline, or in other lecture cycles. They are described as possessing a certain mobility. Other realms of nature also only receive their shapes from the spirits of form once on earth. That is, as I'd like to put it, received their shapes in their abiding permanent form. Let's look at the kingdom next to humans on earth, that of the animals. The realm of animals also inhabits form. It has been displaying the forms it presently does only since earth evolution. But just think about the differences between animal forms and human forms. Our gaze sweeps across the surface of the earth, and we find certain differentiations between individual people, differences belonging among other areas of narrative. But we do find certain external differences in terms of form. All the interesting peoples being deployed by the West Europeans, British and French, at the front, against Central Europe, of course, look very different from the population of Central Europe. So our gaze observes differentiations present across the globe as regards individual people's configuration and shadings. Yet when comparing differentiations between the peoples of the world and those between different species of animals, you will have to concede that the latter contain endlessly more species and types than are contained within humanity. We can speak of a single species of human being as opposed to widely varying species of animal forms. A difference as stark as that between a nightingale and a lion is not to be found in the human realm. Were such great variance found among humans, as is the case between nightingale and lion, nobody could claim that there were no differentiations among humans. Whereupon, your contemplation would confirm that the animal kingdom contains a vastly wider range of species than can be found among us, the universal species of human being. Though what I have just described is perfectly correct, it is nevertheless, from the standpoint of spiritual science, only to a limited extent accurate. Because the following is also correct. In your observations and thoughts about the human physical body, now, add the ether body, and imagine that a certain experiment were possible, one that cannot, of course, possibly be carried out, piece by piece, to dissect the human body, and before starting, to call spirits of the higher hierarchies, angeloi, archangeloi, and archai, to effect a withdrawal from the human in question, such that they would cease being active in their ether body. Two things would need to happen. Let's assume one would not want to maltreat the human being, but one would need to withdraw everything belonging to their physical body. One would then have to bid them withdraw every influence emanating from the three hierarchies of Angeloi, Archangeloi, and Archai, so that the ether body was totally reliant only on itself, uninfluenced by anything else at all. It is unswayed, is set in the physical body, and this latter has its firm shape, as bestowed by the spirits of form. It therefore has to defer to comply with, this firm shape. If you put a very soft lump of rubber into a glass, it will adapt to the shape of the glass and be unable to retain its own shape. On taking it out of the glass, it will spring back to its original shape. Similarly, the human ether body adapts to the form which the physical body imposes on it, not possessing its own form. If we remove the physical body, this force to which the ether body has to adapt falls away. Yet, even then it would not acquire its own shape, because into this ether body, Angeloi, Archangeloi, and Archai are working, something we will look at more closely later. We now bid them to leave, so that the ether body can follow its inherent forces alone. The etheric body would now bounce outward, adopting its own elasticity. Were this to take place, you would see how the ether body expands and takes on its own shape. What would happen? You would have before you the entire animal kingdom. The ether body would divide itself into portions, would apportion itself into the shapes, at least into those of the main species, of the whole animal kingdom. What this means is, human beings bear within themselves, etherically, the entire animal kingdom. It is only bound together, on the one hand, through the shape of the physical body, and on the other by the activity of beings in the three named hierarchies. It is absolutely true that the human being bears, in potential form, this whole animal realm within their ether body. Viewed from this angle, the entire animal kingdom is only differentiated from that of the human, in that each animal species has taken to itself and evolved to physical manifestation its own form, which also coexists in the human etheric. So that when we look at the animal kingdom as manifested on earth, it is in fact the widely dispersed human ether body. Here is something remarkable. Around the turn of the 18th to the 19th centuries, within the evolving world outlook of Europe, there appeared in more detailed form what can be found in personalities such as, for instance, Oken. The natural scientist Oken, readers aside spelled O-K-E-N, end of readers aside, could not yet, in the context of his times, speak of an ether body, something alien to him. Yet among his writings, the remarkable phrase can be found, quote, "the animal kingdom is the dispersed human being," close quote. In other words, he had an imagined conception of the truth. This concept entered his spiritual horizon at a time when those great Central European ideas were in process of developing. That is very interesting. This concept also appeared on Schelling's horizon, and you will find a similar statement among his writings. But those who could not commit to such ingenious but obviously by no means conclusive thoughts, because more detailed facts were not yet available, were scandalized. You must imagine that what Oken could not yet know existed in the form of an inventive idea in his soul. I'd like to say that he had the feeling that the individual members of the human being are actually a composite of animal forms. He had the courage to express this. But the fact that he did so scandalized academic Philistines appallingly. He had also asked himself, what is a tongue? He couldn't know that an ether body was required, so he opined, a tongue is a cuttlefish. Underlying this assertion, however, is what I have just been discussing. Just imagine what academic Philistinism made of that. The human tongue is a cuttlefish. If you want to gain insight into the course of human spiritual life, you need to be broad-minded and open-hearted. You have to be prepared for the fact that the seemingly nonsensical can in fact harbor great truths. Thus Olkin categorized the human being as follows. The tongue is a squid or cuttlefish. Other organs are other creatures, and so on. This was fundamentally a more detailed reiteration of the ancient human view that singled out only the primary species and classified the human being into four main animal archetypes, lion, eagle, angel, and calf. Thus one can say, the matter is not actually quite as simple as that, but human beings do in fact contain the whole animal kingdom within their ether bodies. As a philosopher might say, they contain the potentiality for this. Now you must bear something in mind to avoid any one-sidedness. If what we have just cited were not to take place, if, apart from the physical body holding together this entire animality, the anguloi, archangeloi, and archai were still to exert their forces, then on passing through the gate of death and shedding their physical body, what I have just described would come into effect. In that case, when the ether body is left behind, a few days after death, by the astral body and the ego, that element really would disperse, falling elastically into the world, and the entire etheric animal world would arise from out of the human etheric world. Experientially, this is not the case. It does not arise. It doesn't proceed in this way from the human being. But the ether body detaches itself quite differently by dissolving and becoming woven into cosmic ether. What have we here? Beings from the hierarchy of anguloi, archangeloi, and archai work on our ether bodies, preventing its etheric unity from being splintered into the animal kingdom. What is actually taking place? You see, I'd like to describe what is happening by drawing in the first instance on a comparison. As people on Earth, we work making implements or machines out of wood or iron. Wood or iron are our material basics, and from them we fabricate our appliances. Our task is the disposition or arrangement of matter. But the iron or wood has to be extracted from the earth. We need these raw materials, and we extract them from a realm that lies below our human realm. If you now imagine that above us dwell the anguloi, archangeloi, and archai, they are not in the cosmos for the purpose of enjoying a perpetual Sunday rest, but they too have their work and tasks. What is the actual work of the anguloi, archangeloi, and archai? When at work, they also need material, just as we take iron or wood from the earth, and this they process. The materials processed by the anguloi, archangeloi, and archai are our ether bodies. Much as we process the wood and iron of earth into implements, do the anguloi, archangeloi, and archai elaborate in our ether bodies. They are the raw materials on which they work. We humans go around on earth thinking, if indeed we think any such thought, what we bear in our ether bodies, carrying them around as though they were our property in the way that our lungs are, when all around us an entire hierarchy of anguloi, archangeloi, and archai are elaborating structures for the spiritual world, which are used there for our lives. They extract from our ether bodies what is to be used in spiritual worlds. Whose help do these higher beings call upon? Lifelong, we are thinking, from the moment we begin to think until our very death. The essential aspect of thinking, as you will have gathered from yesterday's public lecture, consists precisely in the fact that thinking lives and weaves in our ether body. It continues living and weaving into our physical body. We believe that in physically embodied life, the thoughts we form are our soul property. But what our thoughts contain, what we cultivate in our thoughts, and back to which we can remember, is to some extent just the inner surface of our thought life. Particularly in respect of our ether bodies, do the anguloi, archangeloi, and archai work throughout our thinking life. It is not superfluous that we as human beings think. Neither is it superfluous for the physical earth, nor indeed for the cosmos. Because what we transform in our ether bodies through our thinking between birth and death is used as material and elaborated in accordance with higher principles. During our lives, while we are going about the world as thinking beings and only seeing our thoughts from the inside, those thoughts are worked upon by Angeloi, Archangeloi, and Archai, so that, after our death, what results may be embodied in the cosmic ether. When our astral body and our ego lay aside our ether body, then, if I may phrase it coarsely, they sew the web of our ether body into the cosmos, that web whose essence has resulted from the manner of our lifelong thinking. Henceforth, this belongs to the cosmos. As human beings, we live not only for ourselves. Being human entails living for the entire cosmos. We know that, after our sojourn on Earth, Jupiter, Venus, and Vulcan epochs are to arise. As preparation for this, everything has to be woven into the cosmos in the form of forces. Work is needed for this to happen. Included in work required for this is, for example, what I have just described, that Angeloi, Archangeloi, and Archai are active in accord with our thoughts. A slightly different material ensues from the foolish or stupid thoughts we entertain during our lives, which in turn differ from our more sensible or sage thoughts. Depending on which sort of material we supply to them, are those, crudely put, etheric machines elaborated, which then enable the onward evolution of the universe to proceed. Thus when, after our death, our ether body is assigned to the cosmos, the work of the three hierarchies named is likewise conferred thither. Let us look at the human astral body from a similar perspective. Whenever we make observations from differing standpoints, different relations with neighboring realms will always result. Someone who can't read, and included in reading is the potential ability to synthesize, they may encounter many contradictions in the phenomena described. But this only stems from not focusing on the points of view from which issues can be illuminated. Our astral body exists in similar relation with its earthly environs, as does our ether body. Our ether body is or encompasses the entire animal kingdom from the perspective I outlined to you. Our astral body is the entire plant kingdom. I would have to describe our astral bodies being related to the plant kingdom exactly as I spoke of the ether body in relation to the animal kingdom. All the plant species on our earth exist within it. And once again, it is a fact that were all the higher hierarchies not to work on our astral body after we underwent the reverse experience of our life from death back to birth, while the astral body was gradually being sloughed off, nothing else would arise other than that the astral body would be discarded and exist as the entire plant world at large in the world. Yes, indeed, this entirety would assemble itself into a globe shape in accordance with its own elasticity. And yet the astral body cannot coalesce into a sphere, because during our lives between birth and death, spirits of form themselves, spirits of movement and spirits of wisdom, and even to some extent spirits of will, have been working on our astral body. When we have spent years or decades freeing the astral body, back in reverse order over the course of our life, as so often described, from its cohesion with earthly life, then this work on the astral body provides spirits of form, those of movement, wisdom, and will, with what they need for their work, embodying into the cosmos that which they need to incorporate into it. What is embodied in the cosmos in this way certainly benefits us, and has to exist in the universe. It is also woven into the cosmic fabric, but differently from what was described earlier. When our ether body is cast off, it is straightway sown, or I could say woven, into the universal world ether. However, what is woven from our astral body, and what appears as the work of spirits of form, of movement, of wisdom, of the thrones, this works in concordance with our I, capital, as it undergoes its time between death and rebirth, containing such forces as have to be active in order that we are able to return to a new incarnation. For vastly much is involved in our being able to embark on a new incarnation. Actually, what superficial physical science today knows about the construction of the skull and the brain is considerable. In fact, so much is known that there are a huge number of people for whom there is simply too much to know. But when you consider the extent of what external science knows about the skull and the brain, how that wondrous construct is created, down to its most minute constituents, how little progress would be made by external science in actually generating them. We are faced with a momentous mystery. Those of limited outlook, whom one might think of as dullards or stuntlings, make short shrift of this mystery by claiming that what is handed down through the generations is spontaneously self-perpetuating, that the human head simply self-generates within the mother's body. You can understand that people might say this, but how clever it is may become clearer from the example I'd like to bring. Hypothetically, we could imagine that there were beings in Munich who could see a great deal, but with the exception of human beings and their activities. It is conceivable that such beings might exist in Munich who could not perceive human beings and their activities. Such beings, blind to humans and their affairs, might, for instance, see clocks. They would be aware that clocks exist and how they were assembled, yet not see the human watchmaker assembling the timepieces. They would just see the components coalescing without the hands carrying out the assembly, though might possibly see the various tweezers, calipers, collets, and so on with which the parts are gripped. In short, they'd see all the components self-assembling out of thin air. What concept would such beings have of a watch? They certainly wouldn't think there were watchmakers in Munich. They would deny that completely. They might think, oh, how frightfully superstitious to think there are clockmakers, knowing as we do that clocks spontaneously self-assemble. This is exactly the sort of assumption people make about whatever gradually takes shape over time on a physical level, that it spontaneously self-generates. In truth, every single thing that arises does so through the actions of the beings of the higher hierarchies, and not just due to the mutual interactions of fathers and mothers, nor is the human being evolving within the mother's body created, quote, of its own accord, close quote. No, the entire universe, together with the beings of the higher hierarchies, is involved in the process. Evidently, the whole cosmos, high into its loftiest regions, is involved in the creation of everything connected with the head, but especially so in the human head itself. Physical science will itself realize, and the leveling up of physical science with spiritual science must ultimately be brought into equilibrium, and learn to think differently about embryology, as indeed to consider differently all the organs. Those other organs, as will be discovered in the not-too-distant future, are strongly dependent on inherited factors. Far less is the human head thus dependent. It is only constrained by its bond with the other organs. Spiritually speaking, the whole cosmos really is involved in the creation of the human head, participating spiritually and being actively focused into the maternal body. The fact that people don't see forces at work, as for instance a farmer doesn't see the forces active in a magnet, is no proof that these forces don't exist. What is present in the human head is, in one sense, prepared, elaborated, in relation to what each human being brings within their I, capital, from their time between death and a new birth, and which is then further transmuted by spirits of form, by spirits of movement, by spirits of wisdom, the thrones, all working on a mighty hollow sphere. What is being worked on here is vast in extent, a sphere into which everything is incorporated. Imagine an immeasurably great sphere into whose global surface is embedded everything to be processed in accordance with the degree to which the human being has given over to the great cosmos the contents of their ether body. This forms something we, as it were, endorse or sign, if I may express it thus. That is to say, that which has been brought with us from the assimilation of the astral body. The time comes, beginning with what I have called in one mystery context the midnight hour of existence, when this sphere begins to shrink, gradually becoming smaller and smaller, and this sphere, which is being transformed by higher spirits in accordance with the earlier incarnations of the human being concerned, ultimately becomes so contracted, ever smaller and smaller, that it unites with the germinal human received into the maternal body. From this evolves primarily the form of the head. This emergence of the shape of the head is a wondrous mystery and is a result of centuries of work by the higher hierarchies. Just think how humans' perception of their relationship with the world can be deepened by knowing how they are placed within the entire cosmic context. Human beings, in burying their heads, need to consider, in all humility, obviously without pride or arrogance, just how little they contain of the wisdom required to form the head bequeathed them. Human beings bear the contents of the entire cosmos within them. Viewed in this way, spiritual science gains enormously by being the point of origin for perceptions or feelings which, in an arrogant soul, can become treacherous. I alluded to this in the second mystery play, where Capasius, in conversation with Benedictus, senses the approach of verities of this kind, that the divine services of the gods are necessary in creating, in bringing forth human beings. Many, especially those susceptible to however unconscious a self-regard, deem themselves all the more elevated on account of this. Human beings can appear monstrously important to themselves. It is more prudent to nurture a sense of how little consciousness one possesses of all the wisdom necessary to bring about a self. You might, of course, share the opinion of those who object. Fine. But why do people need to know all this? They can live perfectly well without knowing all these facets. Therein lies a huge error. In truth, they cannot. We are living in just such times as make us prone to the aberration that we can live on earth perfectly well, eating breakfast, lunch, and dinner, and so on, and can carry on much else besides, and notwithstanding. But this belief is not founded in truth. Eventually, human beings have to be brought round to the fact that their belief is not grounded in truth. On the basis of the above, I now bring in the example of Carl Christian Planck into public lectures. That extraordinary person who lived a solitary life in Ulm for years on end, and whom the University of Tübingen failed to appoint to a then vacant chair because nobody recognized the significance of the man. Of course, stunted intellects will say that toward the end of his life he became so nerve-racked that he said all sorts of self-important things that can be construed as megalomania. Stunted people would say that. But anyone like Planck, who had not fully endorsed spiritual science, would still suffer from their nerves under such treatment by their fellow humans. And yet Planck could say what he did in the opening speech of his titled Testament of a German, in the wake of those words of the ancient Romans, quote, "Ungrateful fatherland, not even my bones shall you have," close quote. I brought in this saying of Carl Christian Planck's, uttered before he died in 1880, as it reflects so well what now confronts us in our European World War. That man of idealistic outlook was well qualified to see reality, because the inner strength he had developed, as one able to plumb the founts of existence through thinking, is also the most practical thinking in the world. The sort of practical which people who reckon they have eaten practical by the spoonful is not actually practical. Only someone who has gleaned what springs from genuine founts of life experience, in spite of humanity's brutality, and after all warranted striving has been crushed to death, can claim to be practical. I am bringing this example to demonstrate how the human power, also vital for outer practical life, that clear, incisive thinking, can only arise when the human soul is enriched by spiritual scientific truths. How can people of our time believe that human life on earth is viable without having any idea of spiritual scientific knowledge? Because they are so infinitely short-sighted. If they weren't so myopic, one could prove purely externally how wrong those are who say that people need not worry about some spiritual world. They would be born of themselves, would bring themselves up. Some sort of education would need to be on offer, but today's education comes up with a sort of massively clever educational principles that reach the dizzying heights of Förster's pedagogy. You would then become one of those stolid citizens who put their mind to what they have to do to feed and water humanity, themselves included. Humanity has not always been like this. Thinking it is possible to live on earth at all without some spiritual knowledge is a recent phenomenon. External proof of this is plentiful, and I'd like to posit to you an example I've outlined in various branches. We could probably find a Munich example if we had time, but here in Munich we don't have such time. This was found recently in a Hamburg art gallery and arose as follows. Let's think of that great symbol at the start of the Old Testament, the temptation of Adam and Eve, which we know to be the Luciferic temptation. Isn't it the case that when this is painted today, no matter whether realistically, idealistically, expressionistically, or impressionistically, in futurist mode or whatever, people will generally believe it to be in accordance with reality, even if they paint Adam and Eve in varying degrees of horribleness. They will include the tree, the snake, as large as the tree with its reptilian head, but certainly with a snake's head. Can this be called realistic in the true sense of the word? I don't think so, my dear friends. Leaving aside all mention of modern women, not even the original archetypal Eve can have been of such limited acuity as to be seduced by a real snake. That can hardly be considered realism. Just think of a real snake slithering through green grass. Is the archetypal Ur-mother Eve supposed to have fallen for its wiles? Even a present-day snake gliding around as an actual creature can only be thought of as a symbol of something else. But now, let's remember which concepts we need to associate with this Luciferic seduction. It is, after all, Luciferic. The serpent can at most be a symbol of Lucifer. Associated with his image is the fact that the being Lucifer remained behind during moon evolution. Nor can this being be seen with physical earthly eyes. With Lucifer still remaining at the stage of moon evolution, he can, of course, not be seen with normal physical eyes, only with one's inner eye, EYE. He can therefore not resemble any terrestrial snake, which can be seen with physical eyes. You have to imagine Lucifer in the way that spiritual science can. Just think, human beings bear their head as the element that is the furthest developed of their limbs. On this hangs, by the most fragile of means, just look at a skeleton, as if hanging, the rest of the organism, albeit the spinal column and cord, also hangs from the skull. Yet what develops later, physically speaking, was formed earlier. Were we to go back in evolution and see Lucifer with our inner eye, we would naturally have to see him at his moon stage, preparing the earthly human head. You would see a human head, not quite yet solidified, internally mobile, still polymorphic, variously shaped, and from it hanging something resembling spinal column and cord, which could be imagined as something akin to a snake's body. You would have to paint Lucifer like this, with as ambiguous a face as possible, and from this head a serpentine body dangling, which is approaching the primal beginnings of a human backbone. This would be a spiritual scientific image of Lucifer. Now, there was in that Hamburg art gallery a 13th or 14th century painting by Master Bertram, depicting the biblical story of creation, where this paradisiacal symbol is painted in such a way that Lucifer, in the form I have just described, thoroughly accords with spiritual science's image. So in the 13th or 14th century, Master Bertram was able to depict Lucifer correctly, as spiritual science can confirm. You can go and see it. It is a historically factual image. We have often spoken of ancient atavistic clairvoyance, which only gradually faded away. Yet what Master Bertram painted is an indication that right into the 13th or 14th centuries, there was still the potential for Lucifer to be correctly depicted in the sense of old atavistic spiritual science. It is therefore possible to prove by external means that it was only a few centuries ago that people became so devoid of spirit as to be as God-forsaken as they now are. You'll find plenty of similar examples. What this means is that what those stunted minds take to be the primal, everlasting nature of the human soul, looking out through one's eyes, combining impressions with reasoning, has only been a quality of human souls for the past few centuries. Previously, all human beings were aware of a connection with spiritual worlds. This died away naturally over time. And yet we find that as late as the 13th or 14th century, people existed who could paint in accord with ancient vision. It is important to take note of facts such as this. From examples such as this, it can be seen how atavistic vision, which as we know had to make way for the elaboration of free will in humanity, still persisted, living on in souls of that time. Because the consciousness soul had to be evolved, that ancient spiritual science had to die out. Today, spiritual science needs to be retrieved. As far as a spirit of creativity and inventiveness is concerned, humanity is still living on legacies passed down from the spirituality of old, in every area of life. Today, if someone has an idea about something that did not previously exist, it is due to old spirituality still working on. But it will only be 50 or 100 years before all inventions and ideas impelled by true creativity and human evolution will have vanished, including in branches of mechanical engineering, if spiritual science does not work fruitfully for humanity. Spiritual science simply has to embed itself actively into the entire evolution of humankind from now on. Otherwise, the soul life of the human race on Earth will become sterile and unproductive. We face this sterility in varying degrees, but especially strongly among the arts. Here, the impression is particularly compelling that people are largely spirit or God forsaken. Unable to find and to insert mysterious elements into works other than what has been prefigured in nature. In other words, when the inner fructification of the spirit is totally absent. These aspects are, on the one hand, they show us how essential it is that we human beings become aware that as truly human totalities, we are interwoven with beings of higher worlds. You can think of people, there are still some today, who are not aware that air exists. For them, it is just empty space. At least it doesn't rise to their consciousness that air exists. Yet the physical body is basically unthinkable without its surrounding air. What are we physically without our surrounding air. We tend to think of people as contained within their skin, but that is a stupid thought. Here is the air. One moment it is within us, then once again outside us. Does air not belong to the human being as much as the muscle in their physical body? Do you not contain what was once external to you, and then again, vice versa? Just as our physical body is at one with air, so are we as regards our soul, as regards our ether body, at one with the beings living and weaving throughout the universe in the form of angeloi, archangeloi, and archai. With our astral body, we are at one with those beings who likewise live and weave throughout the world, the thrones, the spirits of wisdom, of movement, and of form. They are continually at work in us, just as air is always working in our physical body. Knowing this gives us the right consciousness of being human. That is one aspect of the matter. There is another side to it. I would like to call up an image of these two aspects by way of your imagination, and for the purposes of some necessary considerations. Just read title The Brothers Karamazov by Dostoevsky. It is a graphic example. Four personalities, among others, appear in this work. The four sons of the old Karamazov, Dmitri Karamazov, Ivan Karamazov, Alyosha Karamazov, and Pavel Fyodorovich Smerdyakov, putatively a Karamazov. The effect this novel exerted particularly on Central Europe was quite remarkable. It would take me too long to talk about all the ways and means by which this work, The Brothers Karamazov, takes shape out of human life and courses through a soul such as that of Dostoevsky. But I will just say this. One can greatly admire the artistry and incisiveness of his psychology, as people nowadays call it, knowing as they do so little about what really constitutes the art of psychology, and for his finely observed lives. Nevertheless, anyone who may not have absorbed spiritual scientific concepts and percepts, learning that the human being consists of physical body, ether body, astral body, and eye, whether written on a chalkboard or in colors, as was often done for the sake of memorizing, anyone who has not absorbed this intellectually, but who has gradually, over a lifetime, come to experience these elements in human nature, in the way we aim to do over the years, may have an uncomfortable feeling about the largely chaotic depictions in The Brothers Karamazov. However, it does contain many fine observations on life, if you only focus on externals. For instance, the eldest of the Karamazov brothers has a different mother and has quite different character traits from the two middle brothers, Ivan and Alyosha. And the fourth, who is rather childlike, has yet another mother. Old Karamazov is a frightful, phenomenal bounder who carries on all sorts of monkey business, so that this Smerdyakov has an idiosyncratic relationship with the mother, and it is not made clear that he is a son of Karamazov Sr., but I won't tell the story now. Yet when you look at it from the angle as to who the mothers of the four Karamazov brothers were, you may have the feeling there's more to all this than meets the eye. It is noticeable that a European would not go about describing things in this way. Central Europeans tend to describe in far more conscious ways and in descriptions, wouldn't bring in so many subconscious factors as does Dostoevsky. They would assemble more, and in assembling facts they know about, would have less of the richness of a Dostoevsky, who doesn't take the route of what he knows, but transcribes from life itself. Life is indeed richer than the human soul can know, due to the spirit existing behind it. In face of all this, you may feel, much has passed through an endlessly chaotic spirit, through a spirit made chaotic by his epilepsy and through a seriously unhealthy soul, because in our time, just as in nature, human life inclines one to reveal the one thing or the other. Then you may come to a point, if a real sense, a real concept of what is understood by physical body, ether body, astral body, and ego has been acquired, of realizing that in the four Karamazov brothers, human presences are represented, whom one understands rightly if one reflects. One brother presents as a person in whom one element of human nature predominates, where the physical body primarily is active. In another brother, we face a being more predominantly given to activity in the ether body, this being where its activity is centered. In the third brother, the astral body comes to the fore, whereas in the fourth brother, the quality of an eye is more pronounced. It really appears like this when you read the Brothers Karamazov by Dostoevsky and inwardly observe those four characters, such that you might reflect. Because of that whole human vortex affecting the writer and causing him to write chiefly out of the unconscious, these four elements of human nature have the effect that in one the ego, in the next the astral has the upper hand, and so on. So that overall these four Karamazov brothers are like a dismembered human being, somewhat akin to the way in which the animal kingdom is a dismembered ether body. So you will find, if you care to look into it more closely, in Smerdyakov Karamazov, a predominating physical body, in Ivan Karamazov, an ether body at the forefront, in Alyosha, an astral body, and in Dmitri, primarily an I or ego. If this at first seems strange, it is nevertheless viewed from a point of reality, and not as one would construct it. In fact, one would probably construct it quite differently, yet there it is, when viewed in its inherent reality. Herein lies an oddity, that a writer who created chiefly out of his subconscious, and whose soul was chaotic due to his epilepsy, should be nudged toward reality, and who also becomes related via his astral body, again in his unconscious, with all that lives and weaves throughout the world. For, my dear friends, we can well believe that not for nothing are we, like Dostoevsky, already standing under the gallows waiting to be hanged, as others had been before him, waiting and about to be hanged when at the very last moment a reprieve comes. This is something that releases quite different feelings in a human soul from those in a soul which has not undergone any such event, to be hanged at any minute. That needs to be taken into account. All this demonstrates, I'd say, how reality can affect a contemporary soul in such a way that, throughout an entire novel, it can depict four brothers, archetypically endowed, as I described, who can only be understood if one knows about and is able to feel this structure. Then you will also understand why, for example, the one overwhelmingly possessing etheric qualities, and the one who is predominantly physical in body, should be descended from a person who has suffered frequent hysterical episodes. Many other details fall into place wonderfully once you take this into account. From the above, it becomes apparent toward what our time is forging in a folk region, which, as I have so often described, is suited to some extent to giving up the qualities of its blood, qualities that ought to form a connection with Central European qualities, as I outlined the day before yesterday. Understanding what is happening, including by those who are unconsciously woven into this phenomenon, can at present only be achieved with a background in spiritual science. It may seem inane to say that, but let us for once give it expression. The world is profound, and an ability to know or judge something is not the easy matter those people nowadays imagine it to be, who lead lives in the way that some do. People of this ilk dream their way through life in a daze, not knowing the first thing about what is taking place around them. Enormous events lie ahead, and it is not easy to draw people's attention to them. Do you not, after all, belong, not least through your karma, to those who, bit by bit, commit to such things, who listen to them and eventually get to grips over the years with concepts as to what underlies the surface of life? Those outside this movement can sometimes be given hints, but this may not go very far. Then there are those markedly clever individuals who believe, above all, that those who can talk spiritual scientifically, who resort to this assertion or another, know no more than their words. And those who have no idea that everything has to be retrieved from an all-encompassing source of knowledge, but from knowledge that can be corroborated down into its every detail, and which becomes especially interesting when such details are substantiated. That certain things in human evolution need to change will be apparent to you from the two facts I juxtaposed. On the one hand, I showed you what is contained in the human being, and on the other, how to view events that are actually taking place. If someone who has no training in microscopic work looks through a microscope, they will generally not see much. Similarly, the person looking into life in the 19th century East will not generally have seen very much if they remark that Dostoevsky also lived there and wrote a book called The Brothers Karamazov. And because in the content of that book a subterranean element is alive, because it is actually present in himself and is combined with what in turn exists in the East, the concept has arisen in Eastern consciousness relating to a particular approach to life, which they call Karamazov-shchina. Whatever is experienced in imitation of the life of the Karamazov brothers is called Karamazov-shchina. Yes, it is hard to say and is a more qualitative concept than the Munich idea of Stritzinetz, which is far more abstract. Over there, it is more concrete and obviously not the same in meaning, but the concept occupies a central place in life there. It is also applied to art. People know that to understand contemporary life, it is essential to have, in terms of soul background, what can only originate in spiritual science. Similarly, from the external processes so often confronting people nowadays, and from a thoughtful observation of the facts, the same necessity of which I have been speaking is evident, and this I sought to illuminate from two perspectives. The following is an especially depressing aspect of present times. You see, long before the war began, generalized opinions had been expressed. Certain people were held to have delivered outstanding results in their various areas of expertise. There were no particular reasons to oppose them, as they had achieved a great deal, in the sense of present culture, which is materialistic. Then war was declared. These people spoke out. Letters were written. It is quite unbelievable what people, regarded the world over as outstanding, could write once war had broken out. Just read the letters they wrote about the outbreak of war, or read, on another tack now, the letter written by the man, I do not need to share his views with you, who was considered a remarkably committed free spirit, Kropotkin. What kind of senseless, arch-idiotic letters he has written since the outbreak of war. These are things which, after all, carry a great deal of weight. I would like to say, at the moment it is particularly evident, at a time when humanity is facing fast-moving, enormously portentous events, just how little such people, even though they may be exceptional individuals, are of sufficient stature as regards their thinking to face what has broken into their otherwise comfortable, humdrum daily lives. The best of these, in their own regard, are the ordinary Philistines, not, of course, from our standpoint, but in terms of modern opinion. Well, they continue to carry on living and holding forth, each opining from their own standpoint. These personal outlooks, how do they usually come about? It's well known that nowadays people don't respect authority and have their own self-generated views. The views they hold are, by and large, just based on having forgotten in which paper, magazine, or program they heard a given opinion. These are their own views. They differentiate between other foreign news and their own. The salient feature of these latter is that they have forgotten the source from which they were absorbed. All this indicates that much, very, very much, has to become quite different, particularly in respect of spiritual life, and that people will have to get used to not going through life in the way materialists do, who are in fact forever dreaming about the world. They, of course, imagine that others are the dreamers, but the truth is that materialists are the dreamers who never wake up properly. the way spiritual life is regarded really has to change. And the fact that it has to become quite different needs to penetrate into the consciousness precisely of those who want to bind the essential live nerve of a spiritual scientific worldview with their own hearts. We have had to have a more serious exchange of words on the occasion of my present visit, for the simple reason that today matters stand such that we have to take every opportunity, opportunities that may not always present themselves so easily. At the moment, traveling around is difficult. All this is connected with what I have repeatedly mentioned here, which can in turn be seen in the context of all I've said again today. Today I again said that our ether body cannot be seen merely as the bearer of our thoughts, something we drag around and regard as if it were our property, after which it just evaporates. No, it does not simply evaporate. It is the element that becomes woven into the universal cosmic ether after entire hierarchies have worked upon it. When hundreds and thousands of human beings, as is the case at present, are prevented by death from wearing their ether bodies for decades, as would be normal for the span of a human life, and when so many young people are given up to spiritual worlds, to ether worlds, then what I have so often described comes about. These ether bodies remain present, with the portion that would have been allotted for their use now available for the world itself, because no forces are ever lost. These will be up yonder. But as to what effect they will have up yonder will depend on the state of souls down here. Those souls who will in future be able to find strength for spiritual progress will know. Many have undergone a sacrificial death. Their ether bodies are still present. If we can become conscious of them, if we are conscious of their forces, which can radiate inward toward what has been left behind, then a great spiritual revival will be enabled. But there must be souls on earth who are receptive to what is spiritual, to a spiritual perception of the world. Then what abounds in spiritual worlds as a result of all those sacrificial deaths will be made fruitful for the earth. Otherwise, this will become Ahriman's spoils. Because it must not simply be made fruitful for the earth, these things don't come about of themselves, but it has to be made fruitful through the mediation of human souls. For it depends on as many fitting human souls joining in their thinking and their feeling with the forces remaining in the unused ether bodies of those who have undergone sacrificial deaths. Upon this will it depend whether a future cultural epoch on earth will be able to use them in furtherance of that future spiritual age, or whether this abundance becomes the spoils of Ahriman. Think this thought meditatively, my dear friends, and it will become significant for your souls. Then will what I have often spoken here, and with which I also wish to close today, indeed turn out for the good. Quote, from the courage of fighters, from the blood on fields of battle, from the grief of the bereft, from the sacrifice of people, there will grow fruit of spirit. If spirit conscious, souls will turn their thoughts to realms of spirit. Close quote. The end of Lecture 6.